Why don't more big receivers become tight ends? How much does the quarterback's handedness play into a defense's game plan? An apology to our biggest position ranking snub and fixing the rookie wage scale. We have a very busy show because we're opening up the mailbag on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We're done with the position ranking series. We're not going to do kickers and punters, so if you came looking for that, you're out of luck, friend. What we are going to do is open up the mailbag.
Yeah. Well, we got a lot of defensive questions this week for whatever reason, and I know we had talked about ranking offensive linemen because people were demanding that, but we are going to hold off on that till next week, if I understand that correctly.
Oh, are we? Okay. Yeah, we can do that. Why not?
Well, I mean, I can tell you I haven't ranked my linemen, if that factors in at all.
It's a lot of teams to handle. I was just going to split up our original ranking. I don't know if we necessarily have 10 at all three spots, but...
We'll do that if there's time then.
Okay. Well, this was our first segment, which was planning today's show. And now we'll get into the plan part of today's show. All right, here we go. The first question is coming from Jeff. On the tight ends podcast, you emphasize that in the eyes of coaches these days, the tight end is a wide receiver. So my question is, why don't you see more big body wide receivers being converted to tight end? In other words, what is the essential skill set that differentiates a tight end from a wide receiver?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've wondered that myself at times, and... So let's take Jordan Matthews, for example, because I think that's a guy a lot of people know. He was with the Eagles, kind of a consummate possession receiver, I believe. Where is he now? Is he in Buffalo now, San Francisco? And I don't know if he'll make that team there. But Jordan Matthews would be, in my mind's eye, a guy you would do that with. And the problem with Jordan Matthews is he's 6'3", so that's adequate. But he's 215. He weighs 215 pounds, which is about 40 pounds short of what most tight ends are in the NFL. The average tight end is about 250, and there's actually not a lot of variation on that. Remember, Gary, when we did the all small guy team earlier this year, we found that tight ends are pretty much 240 to 255, and there's not much wiggle room in there. So there aren't 250-pound wide receivers. So it's a good notion, but if you put Jordan Matthews up as a tight end, he would get absolutely mauled and destroyed as an inline blocker to the degree that defenses would put their dime personnel in and just treat him as a wide receiver anyway. So there's no benefit to you as an offense to do that.
Niles Paul did it. Niles Paul is a guy who came to the league as a receiver and then got a little bit bigger and played tight end.
Well, sure, you can get, I guess you could add weight and play tight end. I would say Niles Paul, though, he did do it. He was never a true tight end, though. He was more of a hybrid flex. I thought he was really more of an H-back at times, even, the way Washington used him.
Well, what about that? What if you said Jordan Matthews put on 20 pounds and you are going to just be sort of a move-around, H-back, flexed-out sort of tight end?
It's possible. I think the next challenge then would be, okay, well, he might have the body to block, but he's never practiced blocking in his life because he's been a wide receiver since he was probably 8 years old. So can he learn to block on the fly in the NFL? Probably not. And even then, we're talking about playing a new position, unfamiliar. Can't he even carry the weight? He might be able to run around at that body, but can he play football with that kind of extra weight on him? And maybe he could. Offensive linemen do that. But offensive linemen aren't asked to go out and run routes and beat guys in space. And you would still be asked to do that as a tight end. By the time you put all those together, and if Jordan Matthews were able to do it, chances are 6 or 7 lower level, upper level practice squad type of guys, lower level roster guys have come and gone through your organization, and probably any of them would be a safer bet than Matthews in that role.
Okay.
I mean,
Fair enough.
I might be overlooking something. It's not like this is an item I stay up at night thinking about, but I think there's too big of a hurdle to make. It's much easier to take a tight end and convert him to a big receiver than it is the other way around. Devin Funchess, for example, played some tight end at Michigan, and he's now an NFL wide receiver. That's an easier route than the other way.
Okay. No, I like that answer in the end. You sold me. Just enough.
And hopefully we Our sold Jeff, question. Who took the time to send in the question. It's a good question. These are the questions we love. They're good, interesting questions.
Next question is coming from Luke. Do defenses allocate talent or change their coverage to account for quarterback handedness? It is supposedly more difficult for a quarterback to throw across their body. At the least, a quarterback's view for the first few seconds of a play would be toward their dominant hand. If you visualize this, this is me talking now, not Luke. If you visualize it, a quarterback is it's easier to be looking out to your right when you are first taking the snap as opposed to looking back to your left. Would it not make sense to roll coverage or take away shorter routes to that side of the field, the right side of, or defense left side of the field, offense right side of the field, that it would, since it would take a second or two for the quarterback to turn to his non-dominant side, and then even when he does, the throw to that side is more likely to be off target?
Yeah, that's a smart question too. And I think offenses and all things even, say everything is even, which it never is, because the ball, I mean, just in, to one example, the ball would have to be spotted exactly between the hash marks, and well, I don't know, 98% of the time the ball's on one hash or the other. But let's say the game truly is 100% even. Ball's in the middle of the field. It's a 2x2 formation. The defense is in a very pure straight zone or man look, and it's a totally balanced formation. Then I think deciding factor there would be right hand versus left hand. And there are teams, and probably a number of teams, that believe, yeah, offenses are inherently right-handed. The tight end's more likely to line up over there. Number one receivers, play designs, initial reads, they probably are a little more likely to go that way. It's such a small difference that it doesn't matter a whole lot, I would argue. But you'll notice some, like the Seahawks, I don't know if the Seahawks feel this way, but you could make the case that Richard Sherman played left corner because that's where the left corner would be the guy who defends the right-handed side of the offense. So I think there's something to it, but I don't think it's very important overall.
Are you, this is my question, by the way, are you excited about next year when Tua Tagovailoa? I don't know.
We'll probably have to learn to say that one at some point, I'm guessing.
We are going to have it. Tagovailoa, I believe, is how you say it. But he's left-handed.
Yeah.
We haven't had a lefty quarterback in a while.
No, I think the last one, Kellen Moore? Was it truly that long? He played 3 or 4 years ago for Dallas. He played in a week 15 game against the Jets.
And he didn't play very much. I mean, you can go back to Matt Leinart for like a starting left-handed quarterback.
Which is incredible. That's a long time ago. So you'd have to think there's something to that a little bit, wouldn't you? Because I guess it's, what is it, 9% of people overall are left-handed. And in the NFL, though, starting quarterbacks, it's a lot less than 9%. All quarterbacks, it's a lot less than 9%.
You know what is fascinating? Dave Ragone, who is the quarterback's coach in Chicago, is left-handed. He was a lefty quarterback at Louisville, and then I think he bounced around the league a little bit. But he's a lefty quarterback, and he has to go through these mechanics with Trubisky. Basically, he had to reteach himself how to do everything opposite.
Wow.
Because Trubisky is right-handed.
That is interesting. That's very interesting. I know Michael Vick obviously was left-handed. He's the guy that comes to mind. Steve Young would be the other one. Did you know Michael Vick was ambidextrous? So he did a lot of things. Like, he wrote right-handed, but he played football left-handed. Kind of like Phil Mickelson does when he holds a golf club.
LeBron writes left-handed.
So he's ambidextrous as well.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Probably.
And finding out, like, LeBron James, and it's probably part of the reason he's a great athlete, but as a civilian, I don't view it that way. The jealous side of me doesn't. That's just irritating to me that a guy with so many gifts also gets the benefit of ambidextrousness. I bet it's ambidexterity.
Ambidexterity?
Yeah, I bet it is.
Perhaps that's the word?
Yeah.
Ask your doctor. But I don't know if that's the word, but it sounds like a word, so we'll stick with it. But I think it's connected. I think having that sort of balance in your body, in your motor skills, I think that that is part of what makes a great athlete.
Well, the other one thing to caution about the idea that, well, it's okay, he's right-handed, so it's easier to throw to his right. I think that is true in a lot of cases. There are certain throws, though, short throws, quick receiver screens, for example, that I've had quarterback coaches tell me it's easier to throw to your left, because if you're throwing it right away, you've got to get your body into it a certain way, and your body's naturally into it to your left because you have to throw across your body. So you're dealing with your body and your balance in that sense. If you're throwing to your right, though, just think about catching a ball quickly and immediately throwing it to your right, and you have to get your body in it. You have to make a more concerted effort to turn your body into the throw when you're going to your right. So if you have some glitches in your mechanics, they could show up on shorter throws to the right. We're just talking short throws. And I'm not a mechanic. I'm not Tom House. But from what I've been taught and what I understand, certain shorter throws are more difficult going to your right side as a right-handed guy than to your left side.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I know the Derek Carr and the Raiders, it's something they've worked on with him because he's been asked to do so many quick throws, especially out of shotgun, and he's good at it. That's his strength. That's the style of thrower he is. And you just have to be very deliberate with your mechanics and some of that stuff. And then a big part of your mechanics as well is having your front foot pointing to what you're throwing at. And a lot of times when we say, oh, yeah, this footwork's not good, a lot of times that's the issue. Cam Newton's a great example. Cam Newton wows you on two fronts. One is you say, wow, my goodness, a guy can make all kinds of throws, and his foot is pointed completely different from where his shoulders and arms are lined up. His footwork does not match his arm at all. You think, well, he still makes the throw. And then the other wow is, geez, how has he gotten this far in life as a quarterback and not had that corrected yet? Because he still misses plenty of those throws too.
Yeah, but there's also something to be said for there aren't a whole lot of times where you can actually, like, you know, set your feet. You got to throw from a muddy pocket sometimes, and that's where that ability to sort of throw, you know, off your back foot or sort of off balance a little bit comes in handy.
That's a great point. And so what I would love to ask the Dave Ragones of the world or Tom House, who works with a lot of NFL QBs, I would love to ask, all right, so what are the mechanical teaching points that you emphasize in instances where you do have a muddy pocket, where you don't have a clean platform? Because you can't just say, oh, it's a muddy pocket, so let's just throw caution to the wind and hope the arm gets it done. I'm sure there are people that still teach how to throw the ball with compromised footwork, and what are some of the points there? And I would love to hear the answer to that. And then how different are the answers from one guy to the next? Because I'm sure what Tom House would tell Tom Brady in that sense is very different than what he would tell an Aaron Rodgers or a Patrick Mahomes, one of these Gumby-armed guys with a cannon.
Well, we have some questions to answer here, so let's move along. This one's from Dante. Very general question. What are your guys' opinion on next-gen stats? Do you believe in analytics? Everyone, and I'll just speak for you, Andy. Everyone believes in analytics. Analytics tell you a story. They are important. My problem is a lot of people don't understand the story that the numbers are telling you. I mean, you should ask yourself why when you see a statistic that maybe doesn't add up to what you thought, and it calls for further examination.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Analytics get misjudged a lot because they work so well in baseball, where the conditions are the same from one circumstance to the next, largely. Pitcher, batter, same area, little plate, throw the ball over the plate, and we go from there. Football, it's nothing like that. It's 22 guys, open areas, open field. So it's a whole, you know, analytics, you have, when I look at them, I talked to some of my researchers about this, the stats that I'm interested in analytic-wise, and next-gen stats gets into some of this stuff. I don't know if Dante's asking about, so-and-so ran 22 and a half miles per hour on that open field run. I don't mind. That's just kind of a fun fact to me. But if we're talking actual data, analytics, when it tells you how a team is trying to play, that to me is a little bit revealing. So Football Outsiders Almanac just came out. They have a lot of great information on formations and personnel packages and who lined up and what sets. And if you Sharp Football Stats, Warren Sharp site, you can go through those databases and find out how are teams approaching the game in certain scenarios. The problem people make with analytics is they try to use the results as the information. And to me, it's not the results. That's not how coaches look at it very often. It's, you have to think of analytics in terms of revealing the process. How are you approaching the game, and what numbers can we put to that?
Yes, and everyone who listens to this show should get the Football Outsiders Almanac. You should be reading Warren Sharp's stuff. Anyone else who really like Andy?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure there is. I just, off the top of my head, though, I'd have to. Those are the two that stand out. And those Football Outsiders, that really stands out to me. I'm not a big DVOA guy. I respect it, but I don't get too deep into that. And I really love how Football Outsiders, A, does strive to at least make that an intelligent stat, and B, they go to other stats as well. It's not all DVOA stuff.
Yeah.
So I would give a high recommendation for them. I'd have to think more about other guys.
That's good. DVOA is a good snapshot. The problem is when people start saying, well, this team is much better than this team because look at the DVOAs.
Correct, yes. And I was just having another conversation with one of my guys about this as well. And this gets into philosophical difference. A lot of these analytics sites, they believe every snap is equal. It's one snap in isolation, we're going to grade that or use those stats. Now the next snap and the next snap. And I don't believe football is played that way. For one, these plays are called to set up other plays, and snaps lead into other snaps. And you script plays, you go for whole series, you have concepts you try to get into. I don't think football occurs one play at a time with the plays in a vacuum, which is kind of how the analytics tends to tilt with that a little bit. So, which is why stats aren't everything to me. It's how you play, it's what you do in certain scenarios, what you call in crunch time or bigs, it's how you play on third down. Certain things are more important than other things on a snap-by-snap basis, but that's just a philosophy. That's not how everyone sees the game.
All right, this next one coming from Matt Lane. This is less a question and more a theory, and this is something we did ask for theories on. So good on you, Matt, and Andy, you can weigh in once I get to the end of this. Matt writes, quick thought I had on your aging edge rushers versus inside linebackers discussion. It may have less to do with on-field product and more on how teams assess players. NFL teams notoriously undervalue the inside linebacker position. That means teams are unwilling to spend a lot of cap space on Mike linebackers, so they go with younger/cheaper players. On the flip side, edge rusher may be the most important position on this side of the ball, so teams are willing to fork out huge salaries to 30-year-old Von Miller or even moderate salaries to 35-plus-year-old Terrell Suggs, whereas a team would never pay league average salaries to an aging middle linebacker. So I think the small sample size of those inside linebackers may be due to the fact that teams just don't value them. It also helps that older edge guys can add a few more years onto their career by becoming third down specialists. It's a lot harder to be a first and second down specialist as an inside linebacker when you're 35.
Yeah, that last point's a good one. It's interesting because the last guy I can think of who is a household name into his significant 30s, let's call it, as a linebacker was Ray Lewis in 2012. And I know one of the talking points that you kind of heard from people around Baltimore was, hey, you know, Ray really shouldn't be in the nickel package anymore. He's a liability in coverage, but who wants to go tell him that? And I hear what Matt's saying. I don't know. I mean, let's not overthink this too much, though. If there were a linebacker in his 30s who plays that position as well as Von Miller plays his position, that linebacker in his 30s would be employed, no question about it. So unless, am I missing some point of this question, Gary? Because it's not, I don't think it's that these, like, the teams don't value the linebacker. There aren't any good ones in their 30s. The only one that really stands out, and he's now a number three backer, is Sean Lee. So we would need some examples to make this work. He has examples of edge guys in their 30s, but the linebackers aren't there, and I don't think that's any function of salary cap. I think they're not there because there aren't guys who can play.
I think the last part is the best point he makes about third down specialists. You can be an edge guy and just play 25 snaps on third downs and still have a pretty significant impact on the game. You can't really do that. There are no third down specialists among inside linebackers who are 34-year-old nickel guys.
Right.
Because of the way they age, and that's what it gets back to.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with Thomas Davis this year for the Chargers, because if one guy could become that, it would be Thomas Davis. Now, I think he'll probably start and play every down for them in their scheme. But I'm sure the Panthers thought he's going to wash out as a linebacker, as a passing down linebacker at some point, because they drafted Shaq Thompson the first round years ago. And Thompson never supplanted Davis in the sub packages. Davis still wound up on the field in nickel. So Thomas Davis is, what, 36 years old now?
That sounds right. Let's say yes, and you can keep going with your point, and I'll correct you later if I have to.
Well, I guess the point is, at 36, he's still playing at the highest of levels. It'll be interesting to see if he remains on the field in nickel. Remember, the Chargers, by the way, they're a dime defense. They play dime. Mm-hmm. I saw us in the Football Outsiders Almanac, actually. They play dime more than any team in the league by a wide margin last year. It was Adrian Phillips. We talked about that on the safety show a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We might not get a full answer to this because they only keep one linebacker on the field in passing situations. Jatavis Brown is typically their guy they do that with. But we'll see. It's clear, though, Gary, there are two dozen times more 30-something-year-old edge rushers, quality players, than there are linebackers in their 30s.
All right, next up we have Kev with again, it's not a traditional question, but it's a very, very sharp observation here. Kev writes, I guess your listeners prefer to hear about individual players, but I really prefer rankings of groups. Case in point, when Aaron Donald was defensive MVP, that team was almost last in run D. Jerry Hughes and Chandler Jones got votes on the Ed Show, but who cares because their teams are so bad. I think you can learn more about football and individual teams when you rank groups, i.e. top front seven, top offensive line, top secondary, etc., because you will talk about why and maybe mention in contrast why another team is so bad, and then talk about some individual players while doing so. I bet you may highlight some guys who will never be in your top 10 and even get votes, but it would maybe be a strong contributor to a group. So basically, groups over individuals for the ranking show next year, Andy.
I kind of like it. I have to, Kev can purchase the SI NFL Preview magazine this year, because we're going to have that in there, because I got assigned to rank every position group 1 through 32 across the NFL again this year. So that will be in the magazine. I don't know if we'll put it up on MMQB or not. So I think he's right on with that. It is more interesting to talk entire position groups, because not only do you get into, you do touch on individual players, but you get into philosophies and scheme a little bit more overall. And maybe that's something we need to consider next year, certainly. And I do think going through some of the middle tier guys he's right. We would touch on more of them, and that would be interesting as well.
Okay. We'll consider it. We've got not quite a year, but about 10 months to really reconsider what we want to do with our lives and whether we're doing position rankings and whether we want to do them individually or as groups.
Well, so tune in next year. I'll tell you why else it's interesting. His Aaron Donald example, for example, the Rams are fairly average across their D-line, maybe a little above average, but they're not world beaters when you take out Aaron Donald. So if we rank the groups like that, we do kind of get into a different way of ranking Aaron Donald to a certain degree, because we say, oh, well, he's number one, which we kind of all agree with, but we almost, in a way, quantify how far in a way is he number one. How great is he? Because we're having to put him within context of everybody around him. And Aaron Donald versus Fletcher Cox debate is not super interesting. It's Aaron Donald wins that, even though they're both great players. Aaron Donald as part of the Rams and the Rams D-line versus the Eagles D-line, with Fletcher Cox being surrounded by better players than Donald, I think that does get more interesting.
Okay. We'll think about it, Andy. As soon as we finish recording, start thinking about it.
I think my mind's made up. I think I've been sold on this.
Well, there are ebbs and flows in the it's not even the off season. It's the season. And then the off season, including draft season. And then we have to decide after that.
Well, the problem also, if we're just being honest here, is top 10 players is much easier to put a headline on, and you get all the masses of people that want to gripe and hear about that. A smarter topic isn't necessarily a better topic for podcast growth, if we're being completely honest, which I think we ought to thumb our nose at and just do the smarter topic anyway.
All right. Well, speaking of which, I did not run through all the people who sort of had individual player gripes with the player rankings because it's just it kind of gives me a headache. And we heard you on Taylor Lewan and you know, the guy who thought Eddie Jackson should have been like 6, not 8. And everyone who tagged their favorite player in a tweet about our shows, we gotcha. But there was one, and I only read this because I also thought the same thing when we were doing the show. I was shocked this guy didn't get a top 20 vote on the Edge show. This is from Zach. I just finished the Edge Defender show and was surprised no one mentioned Ryan Kerrigan in their top 20, which is true. He got no votes. I always list out, because I go team by team and sort of look at everyone that way. I usually list like 25 to 30 guys. He was 21 for me on the Edge show, and usually whoever's 21 gets a vote from someone, but he did not. He wasn't in our top 20. So Zach is just kind of asking what's up with Ryan Kerrigan. Sorry, Zach, I'm sort of really, really abbreviating your response here, but Ryan Kerrigan, I don't know. I just thought he didn't get the glory of the others receiving votes announcement, so I just thought I'd give him a little pat on the back here.
Yeah, no. What's up with it is we blew it. I mean, he should have gotten votes. I blew it by not voting for him. You barely blew it by having him 21. I don't know who our other voter was, but Ryan Kerrigan's an excellent player. He's, for a while now, been just almost the sole guy in that pass rush. They've tried to put other guys around him, but since they lost Arakpo years ago, it really hasn't gone that way. They haven't had a number two edge rusher to lean on, and yet Kerrigan's production has only risen. He's much more productive now than he was early in his career. He is a tremendous player, and he got shortchanged on our show. It's not a flawless show.
All right, a quick message before we move on. This episode is brought to you by Green Chef, a USDA-certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Meal plans include keto, paleo, balanced living, and plant-powered. Recipes are quick and easy with step-by-step instructions, chef tips, and photos to guide you along. Plus, there's something for everyone with Green Chef's wide variety of high-quality, clean ingredients. You can feel great about what you're eating and how it got to your table. But most of all, it's convenient and easy. Let Green Chef do the meal planning, grocery shopping, and most of the prep work for you week after week. Green Chef is now owned by HelloFresh to offer a wider variety of meal plans to choose from. There's something for everyone. I love switching between the brands for when my tastes change and when I want to eat a little differently one month. Now, our listeners can enjoy both brands at a discount with us. My wife and I actually love the Mediterranean shaved steak. It's easy to make. It's delicious. We've got some left over, and I know Andy's coming to town next week, so maybe if he's lucky. So thank goodness for Green Chef. Otherwise, we'd just be feeding him, like, probably toast, just dry toast. But now, what's in it for you? For a total of $75 off, that's $25 off each of your first three boxes, go to greenchef.com/mmqb75. That's greenchef.com/mmqb75. This week's episode is also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. You know, hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done, ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Andy, your favorite topic coming up here, Martin has a question that I actually held from our last mailbag in the spring about the rookie wage scale. And we're going to get into it right now. Martin writes, the problem here appears to be that the salaries paid to players on rookie deals don't reflect their level of performance. Would adding standard performance-based incentives slash salary increases slash bonuses to all rookie contracts help address this? Would it be worth borrowing something along the lines of MLB arbitration system for players who are obviously outplaying their contracts? Now, Martin makes a good point, because every time I bring this up, Andy just says, well, you're just pro-labor. You just think rookie wage scale is anti-labor, and that's why you don't like it. That is part of why I don't like it. But I don't like it because it makes a farce out of roster building. The Browns, because they go 0-16 or whatever it was, that was after the 0-16 season that they drafted Baker Mayfield. They just get Baker Mayfield on one-third of what he should be making. So they not only get a really good young quarterback, but they don't have to pay him for 5 years just because they were bad the previous season. The draft already addresses the competitive balance. The Browns would get to select any player they wanted, any draft-eligible player they wanted, but the fact that they also don't have to pay that player just makes it a complete farce.
I think there's a simple solution to all this is, and I don't know what the problem is. I don't know what the incentive would be, because who's going to negotiate this in the next CBA? It doesn't really benefit the owners or the players. But the solution, if we're just talking fairness from what you're speaking to, Gary, is make the rookie deals 3 years with a fourth year option for all rookies, but especially first rounders, rather than 4 years with a fifth year. That's too long. That's these guys. There are some guys that almost have to enter free agency outside of their prime, because 5 years, that's a long ways into a career. So 3 years with a fourth year option, that most of these guys, their fate's being decided after year three anyway. And a fifth year option can get picked up after year three. So that's what I think they need to do with this rookie wage scale and leave it at that. I'm not too worried. Nobody's tanked yet. That's never happened. And if it was going to happen, it probably would have years ago, because teams could have gotten earlier draft picks for tanking just like they can now. But you're right. The salary imbalance has become a little bit ridiculous, and they can correct it by just making the rookie deals shorter.
Well, hold that thought for a second, Andy, because that is our next question. But I just want to make one point on the tanking. You don't think, with Trevor Lawrence 2 years away, and Trevor Lawrence is going to be the guy, like right now we always say, we look back to Andrew Luck and say, that was the easiest quarterback evaluation. This guy is the easiest evaluation since Andrew Luck. Trevor Lawrence is going to be the new checkpoint as far as when we look back on who was really the clear-cut number one can't-miss guy in a draft. Trevor Lawrence is coming up in 2 years. You're telling me no one's looking at the Cleveland Browns right now and saying, not we're going to go out and we're going to line up with nine players and we're going to lose every game 70-0, but just sort of saying, we're going to clear out some veterans. We're going to put a B-plus version of our team out there. And our A-plus version was probably a 5-11 type of team. And we're just going to go out there and basically go 2-14 and get Trevor Lawrence.
I don't think so. I don't think so. We bemoan that the NFL doesn't have guaranteed contracts sometimes. And we bemoan that coaches get fired too early, or GMs who seem to have more slack now than they used to, but they can get fired early. It's a lot. Nobody's patient in the NFL is what we're always saying. Well, one of the benefits of nobody being patient is that you don't get anyone who's willing to sign up and think that way and suck for luck or tank or lose and think, well, we're going to be better 2 years from now. The whole 76ers approach, that doesn't happen in pro football, because nobody, players, coaches, executives, nobody has enough job security to actually enact it. And to me, that's not the worst thing in the world. That's a competitive league when you have it that way.
Yeah, no, I think that is great, but I think you are going to get someone who comes in and says, I'm in my first year. This roster is a mess. Let's just play for 2021.
Well, all right, but then when they say that, first of all, let's start with who is saying that. I mean, let's start with one guy to keep this easy.
Okay, let's say hypothetically, let's say the Jacksonville Jaguars go 3-13 this year and they just clean house. It's just not working.
Okay.
New guy comes in and says, "Boy, this is, we've talked about the Jaguars cap situation. It's not good. They're not in a really good spot right now." And this guy just says, "You know what? we need like a year just to tear this thing down, and you know, we're going to go out there, and Nick Foles wasn't very good in his 1 year with the Jaguars, and you know, maybe we'll play him again this year, but it's just not going to go very well. We don't have the roster, so let's clear out some of these veterans. Let's get rid of Calais Campbell. Let's get rid of Marcel Darius, and you know, let's retool this thing, and we're going to go like 2-14 or 1-15, but we're going to get Trevor Lawrence at the end of this year as our prize.
No, I don't think it goes that way.
But it doesn't matter, because that guy has the security to say this is the rebuild we're going to do. I mean, no one really built an NBA team this way until Sam Hinkie.
Right, but all right, but here's the difference. The NBA team has five guys on the floor at once. And yeah, you need to probably have four of them be any good to have a chance to win a title, assuming that some of those four are really, really, really good. So it's not as many you don't need to connect as many times. You don't need to hit on prospects or develop mm-hmm. guys successfully, because you only have to get about four or five really good ones and then find a bench for them. And the NFL, you need 22 starters plus five or six other guys who are going to play a lot for you. So we're talking huge numbers, six times more players that you need at least in order to be successful. So you can't really say, well, we're just going to wait a year and do it, because you can't go out and get 30 guys in 1 year. And would the guy who says, yeah, like your description, Gary, this hypothetical Jaguars, that's happened before. It happens all the time. The Jets did that a few years ago. They released Eric Decker and David Harris, and everyone said, oh, they're tanking. And by the way, mm-hmm. Decker and Harris were out of the league that year. The Jets were not tanking. Those guys couldn't play anymore. But they were releasing expensive veterans, and maybe those veterans were a touch more equipped to play right here and now than the guys who replaced them, the young guys, but that wasn't going to hold true for long, and those veterans weren't good enough to offset the fact that you would lose a year of developing those younger guys. Development is too big a deal in the NFL. You can't lose that for a year. So I believe, yeah, a lot of teams would clear house and just play with younger guys, but once they start playing, these are professionals. They're going to play to win. The Miami Dolphins are a great illustration. When they've started cleaning house a little bit, I think they'll do it a lot this upcoming offseason. But all the while, they're going to play to win, because you can't breed a culture of losers. You can't go to practice and teach guys how to not try to do everything to win. That's not going to get you any better either.
What about the 2011 Colts?
As what? As a tank job?
As it was not an intentional tank job, but it was a horrific team. It was a terrible roster that was completely reclamated by bringing in one quarterback.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course it was. I think it was a little bit more than just bringing in one quarterback. They had a pretty thorough draft that year, but obviously, yes, Andrew Luck was the difference for the Colts, and that team really lucked into that because of going from Peyton Manning to Andrew Luck, the way it shook out. I understand all of that, but no, there was never an intention for that to be. They didn't intend to put themselves in that position. They fell into it. If the Colts had intended to put themselves in that position, we don't know how that would go. I think there'd be something very damaging, though, if a team went out and tried to lose games, which I don't care what the people say. That's basically what you're accusing a team of when you bring out the word tanking. If you don't mean that, then you need to use a different word than tanking, because tanking implies that teams to a large degree, are deliberately trying to lose games. And I don't believe for a second that happens at any competitive level of sports, and especially not the most competitive level of football.
No, I don't think so either. But it's the front office choosing to put out a team that is less than optimal.
Well, we used to call that rebuilding. Why? What happened to the word rebuilding? Why do we? Because tanking implies that you're losing on purpose. Rebuilding is something totally different, and that's what you and I are really describing here.
Aggressive rebuilding. More okay. Aggressive rebuilds. How's that? Like, what would you have called the 76ers?
You know, I don't follow the NBA well enough to grasp the new to get into this kind of nuanced language with it, to be honest with you. I'm aware of what they did. I'm aware that you didn't like it, and I'm aware that you know a lot more about basketball than I do. So, what would you call them, I guess?
I think realistically, that was tanking.
So you think the Sixers, and I'm asking here, let's also not pretend basketball and football are two different sports. In the NBA, yes. You have 82 games, which means, and this is why I am vehemently against 18 games as a concept, and not that it would ever be this extreme, but the more games you have, the less significant the games are, mathematics. And the NBA, you have 82 games, which means you have a lot of utterly meaningless games in the NBA. So it's a little bit different than the NFL. Now, you do have some meaningless games in the NFL, and maybe percentage-wise, it's all the same, but you also have 10 or 12 guys playing utterly meaningless games versus 53 guys playing utterly meaningless games. So if you're a basketball team and you know that we are going to replace 10 of 12 guys this offseason, that's a different perspective than if you're a football team where you know that there's no way we could possibly replace 45 out of 53 guys. We're going to have to keep at least half of these guys. Those are two different scenarios then.
I think you are talking about something far more aggressive than what even the 76ers did. I think the 76ers plan, which to me is tanking, I think it's setting a goal that is not let's win games now. Let's win games this year. Let's try to win games this year. And just going at it so aggressively that you end up just with this cynical, sort of hopeless short-term situation. And I think that's what the NFL invites with the rookie wage scale.
Adam Gase got into an argument last year with a reporter. The reporter basically said Tannehill hasn't played well, and Gase kind of cut him off and said, and this is early in the season, it's maybe been 2 years ago, I don't remember, but he cut him off and said, wait, you're saying he hasn't played well? And the reporter was like, well, the results haven't been good. And Gase said, well, that's a problem. You're always looking at the results. And the reporter said, well, if it's not about results, what is it about? And Gase gave him this little bit of a smirk because Gase's next words were, I can't really talk to you because you don't know what you're talking about. So we can't have a conversation, which is, I understood where he's coming from. Have you heard of the Bill Walsh book, The Score Takes Care of Itself? So that's, if I were Gase, that's what I would have said to the reporter. It's about the process more than the results. And the results are a byproduct of your process. So do teams put on their, when you go into a locker room, Gary, how often do you see on the goals or the objectives or the team's values, all these rah-rah posters that mean something in the NFL to people? Nobody puts up their win games. They say we're gonna hustle. We're gonna play for each other. They have all these concepts with the idea that you'll win if you do those things. That's how I think NFL teams view this. I don't think they view it as we have to win or we have to lose. Ultimately, it comes out like that. But you can't just go in and say, all right, guys, the plan this week's to win the game.
Okay, but I'm still saying teams are going to be tempted to basically build for a throwaway season. How is that? Throwaway seasons, not tanking.
I say once the throwaway season begins, the men involved will be still trying to win football games.
Yes, but that was true of the 76ers. All the players and the coaches were still trying to win games. The front office was not.
I told you I don't follow the NBA like that. If that's the case, I have no problem with that. Many years we called that rebuilding. All of a sudden we came up with this word tanking. Oh, we're going in circles here. But it's all right. I'm right. You're wrong. It's not a big deal, Gary. you'll understand this over time.
Oh man, I can't wait until there's like 4-0-16 teams in the 2020 season because they all want Trevor Lawrence. Next one. Okay, so back to what we were originally talking about, and this question is from Peter. What would happen if running backs could only get 3-year rookie deals? Would more be taking the first round of the draft so teams could get a fourth-year option on them? Would they get bigger second contracts because theoretically they'd be likely to be closer to their prime at the back end of said contract than they currently are? So right now that would put a guy like Christian McCaffrey up for some sort of extension this offseason instead of, you know, talking the Melvin Gordon type guys. But
yeah,
I mean, this is kind of what you're saying. The when we see guys sign these big money contracts in free agency, the rule of thumb for me is always these are all 3-year contracts. All these mega contracts are all basically 3-year commitments. That's how most of them end up getting built out, and that's how most of them play out. But yeah, I mean, the rookie wage scale is especially unfair to running backs, which is what we're obviously seeing right now.
It is, which is why I'd love, and your point about the 3-year contract, that's all the more reason to make those rookie wage scale contracts 3 years with a 4th-year option. I'd love to see that happen. I think that would solve it for a lot of positions. This running back thing will continue to be interesting because there are only about 7 or 8 running backs that probably have true leverage in a contract negotiation. I think Ezekiel Elliott's one of them. So we'll see what happens with Dallas. I do not think Melvin Gordon's one of them. Good as he is not one. McCaffrey would be one. If you take the running back out, does it change the way you have to play offensively? Chargers, it's no. Cowboys, it's yes. Panthers, it'd be yes. Saints would be a yes with Alvin Kamara. So how do those guys get paid? I bet we're going to see more running backs hold out. And I can't wait to see what happens with this Elliott scenario. Le'Veon Bell did it last year, and I probably didn't work out great for him overall. We'll see. He did gain a year of maybe longevity. I don't know. But these running backs have to take a stand, Gary, because the system is set up against them unequivocally. And my concern goes back to, let's say they do put in the 3-year deals for backs or for all rookies. Who would have espoused that? Who would have gone to the tables for that one? Because veteran players are negotiating the CBA. They don't want to do that because why do they care what the rookies get paid? All that does is take money from them as veterans. And owners don't want to do it because why would they want to pay extra for a guy they can get on the cheap? So how would the rookie thing ever get done? Who's campaigning right now in these CBA talks for the rookie deals?
No, exactly. That's how they got the rookie wage scale in to begin with, is they basically told the union, like, oh, what are you doing protecting these guys who aren't even in the union right now? Let us put this rookie wage scale in, and then all you 30-something journeymen will be just swimming in cash.
Right.
It won't just go to the quarterbacks and a select few free agents.
So conceptually, then, all the NFL has to do in the NFLPA is find a rookie wage scale that is as cheap as possible without being so cheap that it incentivizes players coming out of college to go play professional somewhere else, which there aren't a lot of options anyway to go play somewhere else.
XFL, I guess.
Yeah.
All right, one more. And another one that's less a question and more a comment. This is coming from it's what I believe is gibberish in the email address here. But he signs off as hate hearing my name announced on a podcast listener.
Is that so? We don't know this guy's name.
We don't. But I really like the cut of his jib here.
Okay, it better be good because I do not. I don't love encouraging this kind of online behavior.
Andy Benoit is, and I mean this with the greatest humor, a butthole. Football fans don't listen to MMQB because they love rules. I want to know if the RB, if the running back on my team made your top 10 list, and if not, how close was he? I will then happily listen to the rest of the podcast. Happily. Being a stickler for the rules is also known as a conformist or a Jobsworth. The answer to such people often is change the rules. Doesn't satisfy them, but hey, at least we're following the rules. If Andy would prefer to change the name of the podcast to NFL running backs who received at least one vote as a top 10 running back, then, well, it's kind of wordy. But okay, if it makes Andy feel better, then maybe you could consider it. Have at it, guys.
I hope it's a nice ending. Talk. Yeah. Do you? I mean, what am I supposed to say to that? I don't know what you want me to say. I have an issue with listing out 25 guys when we're naming the top 10. That's true. I guess am I a butthole that conforms to the rules? Yeah, maybe that's fine. But they're good rules. What's wrong with conforming to good rules?
You are supposed to look within yourself.
Well, it's hard to do that when you're a butthole. A butthole is inherently empty. There's nothing within myself.
You're supposed to look outside yourself then and see the beauty of the world and realize the mistakes you've made.
Well, we wound up listing every guy anyway, and all it did was expose our Ryan Kerrigan gaffe in the end here.
One gaffe is pretty good, and it wasn't even a gaffe. I mean, you could argue 20 guys are better than him. It's just I didn't think all three of us would.
Yeah, we did him wrong. What's your thought on the butthole conformist email?
Spot on, and I did not write it at all. That was not my pen name. It is not my pen name. All right, Andy, I think that's going to do it for this one. We have all average team and all second chance team. It's coming up next week, perhaps. I don't know. You better subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, because you don't want to risk missing it. But as for now, thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, for making it sound smart. Sorry, guys. It didn't work out so well this week. But thank you to producer Brandon Nix and Scott Brody coming in, doing a little bit of pinch hitting this week and helping us sound, I hope all right. We'll see what happens when this comes out. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. You are the best. We'll do a mailbag again soon enough, so keep sending the questions. Talkback@themmqb.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. If you don't already, please subscribe to the MMQB NFL Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, radio.com/10things, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers, and we will see you guys next week.